I know that it is our tendency, especially I'm pro-life, seriously pro-life, and it's the tendency to assign the absolute worst characteristics to those who perpetrate abortion, and there's no doubt about it. This is a sin. It is a grave misdeed. It is murder. There are no two ways about it, and there's no getting around that. Those who actually perform this deed and aid in the performance of this deed, we tend to characterize them as without conscience, callous, and in some cases, emotionally and psychologically numb to the act that they are perpetrating. Well, we've been talking for the last 20 minutes or so with Rachel McNair. Her research indicates that that is not the case, that there are psychological effects after abortion for those who perform abortions as well. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. Join us, if you would, as we continue for just a few more minutes with Rachel McNair from Consistent Life, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727 is our phone number. Rachel McNair is a director for the Institute for Integrated Social Analysis, a research arm of Consistent Life. She's the author of a book. It's called Perpetration-Induced Traumatic Stress, The Psychological Consequences of Killing, and she's written an article in a recent edition of Touchstone magazine that summarizes one of the chapters of her book. The article is called The Nightmares of Choice. She joins us from Kansas City. Let's go to the phones. We have a listener in DeSoto on the line. Welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to address this to Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very painful subject to me. It wasn't myself, but my 38-year-old daughter had five children. For one reason or another, she had an abortion. Mm-hmm. And she started having really bad nightmares.
Yeah.
And about the actual abortion and lifting up this blue paper that the baby was under, which she didn't actually see when she had an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
But it was she wouldn't mention it to me, but she told my sister, who had an abortion herself, and she got her to a crisis center, and she was in there several hours and came out.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't believe in God before the mascara running down her eyes, and said, "Well, I'm Peggy, I guess I got myself born again." But I didn't know that other people had these. About 6 or 7 months after that, she was killed in an automobile accident.
Mm.
But it might even be a blessing in some cases that would drive people to God to keep, to get them through their conscience.
Thank you very much for the call. You also point out in your article that these dreams, mm-hmm. those who perpetrate, that these may be, in effect, warnings, if only of one's own conscience.
Well, the role of what those dreams do, we do know that a lot of people, doctors and nurses who have done abortions, stop, and after they've been out of the system for a while, a lot of them become pro-life. I mean, you very rarely get one hopping straight from being an abortion provider to being pro-life, but a lot of them, if they can get out of the situation for a while, after a while they do become pro-life, and it would make some sense that might be part of the role of what happens, because it's one thing for people on the street to be pro-life that have not much to do with abortion, but when you're having to say that what you've been doing for several years is wrong, there might be some role in that. But we also know that those who do become pro-life end up having therapy. A lot of the groups have group therapy and so forth that seems to be helpful to them. It's a healing process, but they can't start healing, of course, until they're out of the system. But a lot, there's just so much more study that needs to go on that, and it is frustrating study to do, because you know what? Abortion doctors don't want to sit down and have long heart-to-heart talks with people like me. I wish they did. I'm a real nice person to talk to. I could have a good heart-to-heart with them, but it's a very difficult thing to research, because, of course, as soon as you do, they accuse you of being partisan, on the issue. And so those that are still in it don't want to talk. And given that, it's fascinating how often information does come out.
One of the things that struck me in your Touchstone article is the degree to which those who perform abortions and are willing to talk about the psychological and emotional effects afterward will speak of this in terms of killing, in terms of murder.
It is interesting how often that will happen and how often they will say they have moral qualms. And they'll say this in the context of, I mean, it's not pro-lifers that are saying, well, they ought to say this, and therefore we're going to see them as saying it, whether they're saying it or not. These are beings reported in sources that are either the doctors or nurses themselves or researchers who strongly favor abortion being legal. We do find that the theme does, in fact, come up quite frequently.
One last thing before we let you go, Rachel. You have a sidebar in Touchstone's article titled Nobody Knows What This Is. It's a mm-hmm. story of a doctor. I'd like you to tell the story briefly and describe the other extreme of psychological response to performing abortions, which would just be kind of an estrangement or a numbing of emotion.
Right. Well, if you look up in the psychiatric manual, it gives like a list of things that are symptoms for post-traumatic stress disorder. And I wasn't really interested in getting all the way to a diagnosis. I'm just interested in that list because if you have one problem, then that is of interest. But, you know, people think of the avoiding and the intrusive kind of things as being opposites. You know, the numbing and the unwanted thoughts that you can't get rid of as being opposites. But actually, they do tend to go together. This is what we find in the various studies, all kinds of, you know, like I said, the soldiers and all this kind of thing, that this kind of extreme numbing and the intrusive thoughts you can't get rid of and flashbacks and nightmares actually tend to go together more. And what this story was is a fellow who had one of the unborn babies and had put it inside a rubber glove and had blown up the glove and was just kind of tossing it around like it was no big deal. And the nurse was freaking and said, you know, doctor, come on, you know, that's disrespectful. You can't do that. And the doctor's like, well, nobody knows what this is. No big deal. And, you know, the inclination from pro-lifers is to look at that and say, well, that's awful. That's callous. But, see, this kind of numbing, the emotional numbing, is a common post-trauma kind of symptom. And, in fact, you can't get a post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis without that kind of thing. And rather than saying, oh, isn't this awful, you can say, this person is ill. This person needs some serious healing.
Rachel McNair, thank you very much for being our guest. And keep up the good work. I hope to talk to you again on this subject.
Sure.
Rachel McNair is director of the Institute for Integrated Social Analysis, a research arm of Consistent Life. Now, here's the website address for Consistent Life. It's very easy to remember. www.consistent-life.org. That's consistent-life.org. For the remainder of this hour, open lines for your questions and your comments. George Barna has got some research I'd like to share with you here in just a moment, and his research purports to say why small churches struggle to grow and why the big ones grow. His answer to this is really very interesting. Now, I've said many times that George Barna's research, the research itself, his methodology, is sound. Simply the data. That needs to be distinguished from the conclusions drawn by George Barna from time to time, which sometimes, based on sound research and decent data, are simply bogus. This may be a case of that. I'd like to know what you think about it as well when I share the research with you in just a moment. It is open lines for the remainder of this second hour of Issues, Etc. We are back live with you this Tuesday, September the 2nd. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Anything you want to talk about, as usual, during open lines, but I've got plenty to talk about as well, and feel free to react to it as I bring it before you. Pastor Will Wheaton joins us in about 40 minutes. He's pastor of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois, a regular guest here, and a we might even say in the Issues Etc. House, a household term now. We're on the eighth of our multi-part series on the historic liturgy. Today we're going to be talking about, in the last hour of the program, the words of institution at the Lord's Supper, the Lord's Prayer, and the peace that Christians share in the historic liturgy. That's in the third hour of Issues Etc. It's open lines 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. There are two things I want to talk about that struck my interest today. One of them is this Barna research. He says he's found out why small churches stay small. And you will be surprised at the percentage of churches in America, Protestant churches, that would be called small churches. All right? The other thing I'd like to talk about, and this as briefly as I can, was a little bit occasioned by Ellen Goodman's recent column called A Lesson for Alabama from Iraq, Democracy Battles Theocracy in Iraq, Streets and Courts. People have been saying all along, remember the Ten Commandments monument that got taken out last week? They've been saying, well, the U.S. Supreme Court is really being disingenuous and refusing to hear the case, because the U.S. Supreme Court, the Ten Commandments, are all over the place up there in Washington, D.C. They're out on the outside of the building, they're on the doors, yada, yada, yada. And I thought to myself, okay, I've never been there, I haven't seen it, I'll go and look. I didn't actually go to Washington, D.C., but I went on the web, and I got pictures of the actual artwork on the outside of the Supreme Court building. The friezes, that's what they're called, these low-relief carvings in the limestone of the all four sides of the Supreme Court, by the way, have these friezes on them. The bronze doors at the outside of the Supreme Court, and then this famous set of oak doors from the hallway into the actual Supreme Court chamber that is supposed to have the Ten Commandments on them. And you know what I found? I didn't find the Ten Commandments. You know what I found? I found pictures of tablets with the numbers 1 through 10 on them, but the actual commandments weren't there. Now, I don't know what to make of this, except that when we say the Ten Commandments are in the Supreme Court building, on the walls of the Supreme Court building, is it enough just to have a picture of tablets with 1 through 10 on them in Roman numerals? Just numbers? Is that what the Ten Commandments are now? Just numbers? I mean, at best you can say these are symbolic representations of the Ten Commandments. Okay, but just think of it in these terms, and I'll share this a little bit with you in just a minute. If I said to anybody, hey, guess what? I'm teaching my children the Ten Commandments. I'm teaching them to recite the Ten Commandments. What would you think I was teaching them to recite, right? I'm teaching them all about the Ten Commandments. You'd think I was teaching them things like, you shall have no other gods before me. Make no graven images. Remember the Sabbath day. Do not take my name in vain. Do not commit adultery. Honor your father and mother. A little out of order, but that's, you get the idea, right? What if you showed up at my house and I said, hey, come on in, we're going to be doing the Ten Commandments thing, and I just sat there with a couple of tablets with 1 through 10 printed on them and said, all right, kids, let's do the Ten Commandments. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All right, that's the first table. And they recite it back to me. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Good, Jimmy, you've learned the first half of the Ten Commandments. Well, you know, Ellen Goodman points out that while a vast majority of Americans, and it's true, probably somewhere near 70% of the people who are surveyed in the United States thinks that the Ten Commandments belong in the rotunda of the Alabama State Courthouse, ask them to tell you what those Ten Commandments are, and the percentages begin to fall precipitously. First, George Barna. And, you know, I wonder if we didn't call them the Ten Commandments, but called them something like just God's commandments, how many Americans would be able to tell you there are even 10 of them? The research from George Barna is this: small churches struggle to grow because of the people they attract. Well, what do you know? Because of the people they attract. Now, I want you to listen carefully, because, at least according to George Barna, the United States is dominated by what he calls small churches, average attendance, less than 90 adults on a typical weekend. And while the greatest attention flows to congregations that have over 1,000 adults on the typical weekend, the vast majority of people in church on Sunday morning, on any given Sunday, are sitting in a group of no more than 100 people. Now, George Barna has been wondering, why do the big get bigger and the small stay small? Well, I have a few explanations for that, but George says it has to do with the fact that small churches tend to, they don't attract the right element to grow churches. This is from his website, Barna Research Online. It's just barna.org if you want to look it up for yourself. And by the way, I'd be happy to hear from some of you in those small churches. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Tell me if this sounds fishy to you. Not the research, not the data, the conclusion. Based on a study of church-going habits of 4,501 adults randomly sampled from the U.S., the Barna survey discovered that small churches, defined as average weekend attendance of 100 or fewer adults, are more likely than either mid-sized, and that's anywhere from 300 to 1,000, or large churches, 1,000 or more, to draw people who are, one, not college graduates. They are more likely to appeal to people with lower household incomes. George Barna, director of the study, suggests that a, quote, downscale demographic profile often correlates with less aggressive growth patterns in organizations and here's what caught my attention, a limited number of effective leaders. Now, I'm talking to you people out there who go to church. Maybe there's 100 people there. Maybe there's 200. But you're in a small church and you know it. Barna says the reason your church is staying small is because you have a downscale demographic profile. And that you simply have a limited number of effective leaders because you come from a lower socioeconomic strata and because fewer people in your congregation are college graduates. Now, someone says numbers don't lie. But I think there's reason to question Barna's conclusion here. I want to hear from you in the small church. Do you suffer from a lack of effective leaders because the average person in your congregation makes less than the average person in a larger congregation or has less education than the average person in a larger congregation? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Pastors, is this your experience? That the smaller congregations stay small because their people don't make enough money and are just basically less educated and therefore are not effective leaders for growth? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Surprisingly, in spite of the fact that everyone has been telling us for 3 decades that large churches are large because they attract that key, that golden nugget of the demographic pie in America, the 20 to 35-year-old. You know, after all, we're doing this for the kids. Surprisingly, the research of Barna's research group showed that adults under 35 years of age are more likely than older adults to attend smaller churches. When was the last time you heard someone talk about these smaller churches? And it's always in the same stereotype. They're small, they're dying, they're going nowhere, they're full of greatest generation. Yeah, they did their bit for us in World War II, but now they're just kind of taking up space in these smaller churches. They're not changing. They're small. They're dying. The older people, that's the only people who want to go to these places because they want it the way it was back, you know, in the days when they were the flappers or, you know, whatever. Nostalgia for the past. All these stereotypes of the small church. And yet Barna's research, if he is to be believed, the numbers say that people under the age of 35 are more attracted to the smaller church than to the larger ones. They're more likely to attend the smaller church. He finds 2 reasons for this. First is the relative absence of children among younger adults. He says this impacts one's choice of a church because providing children with quality ministry experience, whatever that is one of the main reasons why many Americans attend a church. make note of this, folks. They may not be coming to your church because you're actually doing anything right. They may be coming because you just have a preschool and a daycare. They may not even be coming because they're hearing about Jesus. I wonder if anyone would have the courage to actually do an honest survey of their members and say, why do you really go to this church? Lay aside your pious platitudes and what you think the pastor wants to hear. Why do you really go to this church? Well, Pastor, to be honest with you, you get the cheapest daycare in town. And we figure since it's the Christian outfit, our kids probably won't get molested. Or, well, Pastor, you know, the public schools are a mess and our school district is underfunded and you guys have the school and we figure at least they won't get shot at a Christian school. The other reason that Barna believes that people under 35 are more likely to attend smaller churches is because the baby bust generation has a disinterest in participating in boomer-led organizations. Busters are more interested in being personally known and connected, which many believe is more difficult to accomplish in larger churches. I'm going to read that one again. The baby bust generation is disinterested in participating in boomer-led organizations. Now, Barna may have actually stumbled upon something here without even noticing it, and that is, if the larger churches, he has basically said, are boomer-led organizations. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Now, if your pastor has been quoting George Barna to you all the time to demand that your church change, has he brought this one up to you? Has he mentioned this little factoid to you? And to speak to the broader church bodies, the broader church bodies are all about getting out there and reaching the maximum number of people. And we're being told lately the only way to do that that's effective anymore is to get as many people in church in one church as possible. The idea of the old idea, this worn out, tired old idea of people just actually showing up at a medium sized church with maybe no more than 100 members, that's passé. You can't do ministry with 100 members. You need more money than that. You need more resources than that. This, after all, we're living in a postmodern era. That seems to fail to take into account that 90% of the people who are in church on Sunday mornings are there in a group of under 90 people. The other thing that Barna noted is that larger churches tend to be more conservative. I'll get to that in just a second. In fact, right after this break, we'll find out whether or not they are actually theologically conservative. Now, I'd like to hear from some of you in the smaller churches. What do you make of Barna's latest research? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Call me during this break. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Angel worship, secret knowledge, reliance on human wisdom. Sounds like American spirituality in the 21st century, but these same heresies were also popular in the first century city of Colossae. What can we learn today from Paul's letter to the Church of Colossae? Find out with the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, the Concordia Commentary on Colossians. The book is published by Concordia Publishing House. The phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this brand new commentary on our website, issuesetc.org. Click the What's New section. That's issuesetc.org. The Concordia Commentary on Colossians is written by Dr. Paul Dieterding and costs $39.99 plus shipping and handling. The Concordia Commentary on Colossians, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September. For more information, Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. pro-life Americans are used to bad news, but today we have an encouraging development to tell you about. Americans United for Life says pro-life laws are advancing across the U.S. Terry Phillips takes a look at where the victories are occurring.
From more money flowing to crisis pregnancy centers to legislation banning late-term abortions, 2003 has been gratifying for those who oppose abortion. Carol Everett of the Heidi Foundation, a pro-life center in Texas, says more women are looking at the life option first.
In areas across the nation, our client load is increasing and doubling, and now it's time to start thinking about seeing 5 million women a year who need our help.
The AUL report cites legislative victories that brought abortion clinics under stricter standards. Everett says Texas began enforcing minimal health requirements on abortion clinics, and 40% closed their doors.
One abortion provider literally said, "I will not buy a new sterilizer. If these regulations go into effect, I will close my clinic." And she did.
Dr. Julie Parton, manager of the Crisis Pregnancy Ministry at Focus on the Family, has a qualifying reminder about the upbeat report.
While we do want people to be encouraged that our message is being heard and God's truth is penetrating people's thinking, we still mustn't think that we can just sit back on our hands and that we can just relax now. Far from it.
In fact, Everett says 3,500 of the crisis pregnancy centers are dramatically increasing their services.
So this is a time for Christians to get involved in the missionary outreach in their own area.
The news is good, but it needs to be better. For Family News and Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
Other positive trends involve state action to study and recommend alternatives in the assisted suicide debate, especially in the area of controlling pain and providing end-of-life care. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Be sure and bring the family to Kids Appreciation Day at Concordia Christian Books and Gifts on Saturday, September 13th, between 10 and 11:30. Hi, this is Paul Clayton. We'll be giving away some great prizes. Be sure and register on the air when you hear the VeggieTale sounder.
Just another way God made me special.
When you hear that, call 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Register for the prizes. We'll give away Kids Appreciation Day, Saturday, September 13th.
What does it mean that every believer is perfect in Christ? You can find out with the new Concordia Commentary on Colossians by Dr. Paul Dieterding. The Concordia Commentary on Colossians is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Concordia Commentary on Colossians is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this commentary at issuesetc.org. Click the What's New section.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. It's Open Lines. We are coming to you live this Tuesday, the 2nd of September. Since it is a new month, we have a new Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September. It's the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Colossians, written by Dr. Paul Dieterding. Now, these commentaries are not your average what do you think it means kind of commentaries. They are what's called critical commentaries. In other words, they take a look at the text itself. They do a careful analysis of what the text actually is saying. It's not written at the level that a scholar could only understand. It's written at the level that everyone can understand. It is an in-depth commentary on any of these books, but of course, in this case, on the book of Colossians. Any layperson picking it up will find a wealth, not only of information, but of insight in this commentary series. And the Book of Colossians is our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September by Dr. Paul Dieterding. You can order the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September by calling Concordia Publishing House in the next 25 minutes. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can also pick it up at Concordia Publishing House. They have two locations, two bookstores here in St. Louis. One is located at 3558 Jefferson Avenue South, and the other here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. That's at 3558 Jefferson Avenue South, or here on the campus of Concordia Seminary at 801 DeMunn in Clayton. You can also order the book online. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section, and you'll find information on the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Colossians. George Barna is defining small churches as those with 100 or less, actually he says 90 or less, in attendance on any given Sunday, any given weekend. There's the medium churches, those are from 300 to 1,000, and then there are the large churches, which are 1,000 and above on a weekend. Barna says small churches stay small because they attract, even though they're attracting people 35 and under, which is that golden demographic that everybody seems to want, they attract people who are less likely to be college educated and less likely to make a certain amount of money. And he says, well, you know, you got the, he calls it the downscaled demographic profile. So you're not going to have as effective leadership there. And after it's, you know, kind of the bumpkin syndrome, unfortunately, for those small congregations. What do you think about this? And conversely, he says large congregations will attract people who make more money. He actually uses the term upscale demographic. And they're going to be more effective leaders. That's his conclusion. What do you think? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, he also says that smaller congregations tend to be a little more deviant when it comes to their basic theological beliefs. People in smaller congregations are less likely to be born again. That's a technical category for George Barna. He defines born-again people not by the fact that they say they're born again, but, well, yes, but also, there's no. This is not a theological definition for Barna. He says it, that a born-again person says that they're very committed to their faith, that they believe they've had a born-again experience, and that they believe in Jesus Christ, their Lord and Savior. They read their Bible regularly, and they pray. He says that makes you born again. And he says they're also less likely in small churches to believe by believe in salvation by grace alone, less likely to have an orthodox view of God. And he says, well, you know, that might indicate something there, too, that a solid theological foundation for congregational growth may be necessary. Maybe those churches are staying small because they don't have a solid theological foundation. And I would tend to agree with him there. The irony of it is that the larger churches, by and large, are saying, look, we need to be less distinct theologically. These issues of theology, while they're nice, they're fine, eventually we'll get to those things. This really isn't a theological enterprise. You wonder if that kind of growth can be sustained if the theological foundation is basically being taken out from underneath it. And finally, he says that large churches in particular appeal to baby boomers. One quarter of the church-going population are boomers. That's no surprise because they constitute about 80, we're talking about 80 million people in the United States. I'm included among them. One quarter of the church-going boomer population attends churches of 500 or more adults, compared to just one-sixth of church-going busters, that's 17%. And this is Barna talking, not Wilkin. Boomers are infamous for equating success with growth and large-scale operations. Boomers are infamous. This is George Barna's conclusion, one that I wholeheartedly agree with. Boomers are infamous for equating success with growth and large-scale operations. In other words, if it's getting bigger, it must be successful. And if it's large-scale, it must be better than small-scale. What do you think? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'd like very much to hear from some of you in the small congregations. Does this sound like your church? Does your church suffer from bumpkin syndrome? Less educated, makes less money, ergo less leadership, and that's why your church stays small. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Barb is calling from DeSoto. Barb, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Well, I would have to respectfully disagree with Mr. Barna. He's obviously not been in our church. And I go to a small church that has its share of struggles, its imperfections. It's surrounded by a lot of bigger and more Pentecostal, Baptist, you know, various influences like that. It's not, you know, it's your typical biblical Bible Belt community. But it attracts people that are hungry, that are tired of being under the law, that need to hear the word of forgiveness, and it's got a pastor in place that happens to, you know, stick by that and give it to us what we need.
And it's a small congregation, Barb?
Yes, uh-huh. It's under 100. At least average attendance is under 100. But and just it has something different than what the rest of the community has. That's not to knock them, but for those of us who have felt totally under the law and who need to hear that pure gospel, it's a godsend. And the fact that it struggles, I think, the fact that it does have its troubles shows that, you know, they say that the devil never works where, you know, nothing's going on. So that's all I have to say about that.
All right, Barb, thank you very much. I think she's talking about Grace Lutheran Church down there in DeSoto, and the pastor down there, very decent fellow, Pastor Flo. Now, you might want to check that out if you're down in the DeSoto area and you're tired of being under the law, too, if you want to hear a little forgiveness for a change. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Cindy is on the line. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. You know, I was listening to all the things that you were reading, and I'm wondering if these things are going to lead, all these, you know, qualifiers are going to lead to a caste system among Christians.
How do you mean that?
Well, I go to the church that has all the people who are college graduates. Well, and we're better than all you people who don't go to the church, you know, where there are a lot of college graduates. And so because of that, we've got to be better.
Yeah, I think I hear what you're saying, Cindy.
And if I go to a church where there are bumpkins, you know, I'm going to feel bad about myself because I want to be not a bumpkin.
Yeah, and you know what? If these things are true, Cindy, the logical thing would be for the churches with all the college graduates and the higher income to tell us poor bumpkins what we ought to be doing.
Exactly. And,
yeah.
Okay. And then, like, well, so what does that make Jesus and the 12 disciples? I mean, were they bumpkins or were they college graduates? I mean, you know, Matthew was probably an educated guy, right? Don't you think he, you know, being a tax collector and all?
Oh, Cindy, that was then. This is now.
Au contraire.
That was then. This is now. You know.
Au contraire, Baldy. I'm sorry, Pastor Wilkins.
When was the last time the church took its cue from Jesus and the apostles?
Pastor.
My goodness.
Oh, no, we got to go. We don't want to go forward.
You cannot apply first century methodology to 21st century people. It just doesn't work.
Oh, wrong. Poor George Barna. He needs to just go, I don't know, away.
No, I want him to stay.
Okay.
I like having guys like George Barna around.
Okay, so that we can see, you know, what the whole thing is, see the whole picture maybe?
His data is largely sound. It's his conclusions that sometimes are, you can draw incorrect conclusions from sound data. Facts may not mislead you, but people can draw incorrect conclusions from decent facts. Now, I'm playing a little game with Cindy there, right? I'm being a little bit facetious, but that is essentially what we're being told today, isn't it? It's essentially, you cannot take the means and methods of the first century. It worked for the apostles. Yeah, I know all they did was preach Christ. I know that's all they did. I know that they didn't have marketing gurus to tell them what to do. I know that they didn't have consultants to tell them what to do. I know that they did not have the best and the brightest of people attracted in, you know, into the early Christian church. And their methods worked kind of in spite of themselves for the first century because, you know, it was the first century. But this is the 21st century. America. The times, they are a-changing. This is America. You don't understand that we live in an age that is so vastly different from all previous ages that everything has got to accommodate itself to this. We live in a new age, and this new age requires new means, new methods. The first century method, just going out and preaching Christ and baptizing, teaching them to observe everything I have commanded you, that kind of stuff doesn't work anymore. Well, maybe it does work, but it doesn't work without a lot of help. You know, in the first century, Jesus and the apostles basically presented man's elemental problem as his sin and the death that is the consequence of sin. And that was great for the first century. But 21st century people have much more refined tastes and needs and ways of understanding themselves. We can't waste our time talking to people about sin and death when what they're concerned about is paying the bills and raising their kids. Again, I'm being facetious. You wonder how the church grew before there was such a thing as a college graduate. You wonder how the church grew when the median income of everyone was what we would consider in our modern day to be poverty. You wonder how the church grew before there were people bright enough to tell us that, you know, what worked for Jesus and the apostles just won't work today. And after all, the church is all about what works. Not only does this indicate to me a distrust for God, Paul was so naive as to say, I mean, listen to the naivete in what Paul said. He said, faith comes by hearing and hearing by the message of Christ. How naive can you get? He said, the gospel is the power of God unto salvation. Oh, Paul. Poor naive Paul. We've become better than God at getting God's stuff out, haven't we? Or at least we think we are. God may have his power unto salvation, but it ain't nothing without our power of marketing and persuasion and personality and organization. Let's go back to the phones. Miles, thank you for waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
You had to say all that just when I was waiting to talk. I can't add anything to any of that. I confess I'm absolutely livid hearing the things that Barna has written. I think a little bit analytically I could say, you know, there's a difference between describing something you see and then prescribing something that'll work. You know, I'm sure that he looks at bigger churches and sees all these factors, but I don't think you can say that starting with the factors he's observing will create a large church. On the other hand, it might, but who needs the physician, the sick or the people that aren't sick? There's so many things in my mind about this topic. One thing I see, though, is it seems like only large churches are willing to help. It seems like the large churches have more outreach to people that have, you know, personal needs. And yet, at a small church, what's the congregant to pastor ratio, if you think about that? So you should be able to get better spiritual counseling at a small church.
Well, I'll tell you this much. Try getting the pastor, and I'll be quite honest with you guys, I am the member of a very large church. It's a very large church, at least by the way Lutherans count large. I mean, the way Lutherans count large is kind of like, you know, the difference between a guy who fishes in the local lake and a guy who does deep sea fishing. When the guy who does deep sea fishing said he caught a big fish, he means 8 feet long. When the guy who fishes in the local lake says he caught a big fish, he means 18 inches, okay? Lutherans are in the little lake. What we call big is what the Baptists call small to medium-sized.
I think we're fortunate for that.
Well, maybe we are, maybe we're not. I'm a member of a large Lutheran church, but here's just a good example of what you said, Miles. Try and get your pastor on the phone.
Well, and just in this personal...
And then count on him knowing who you are when he actually answers.
In my case, it would work, but I think it's a challenge. And also, as usual, these church growth guys are actually behind the times. In systems analysis and other areas, people have discovered that a large amount of smaller systems can solve many problems a lot better and in fact can solve problems that can't be solved by a small number of large systems.
Miles, so, thank you very much. Now, that's to give the church growth gurus their due. That's why they've been pushing small groups for so long. But isn't it interesting? Come to our church that's so monumentally large, the pastor may not even know who you are. And you certainly can't get him on the phone. You can get one of his assistants or one of his assistant's assistants on the phone without too much trouble after you go through the whole cadre of secretaries. But if you want to actually get him on the phone, you will have to schedule an appointment, and you'll probably have to rate in some way to get an actual some FaceTime with the pastor to actually have a conversation. Oh, and our church is so large, but when you come, you'll become a member of a small group, which, of course, the pastor will kindly pick out for you. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Vince, thank you for waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, I was listening to your show on the radio coming back to Illinois, and I'm an educated, trained minister. I have 2 graduate-level degrees, and I heard the talk about the whole college graduate slash country bumpkin debate, and I wanted to throw something in there. You know, I've served in a church before. I've also served our country as a chaplain, and I can tell you right now that when it comes to being a chaplain, I have to meet certain educational criteria, i.e. a master's degree, where it shows that I'm learned and I know more about the Bible than just cracking it open and preaching God's word. And that's the one thing that's really bothered me about many of these, you know, new church growth movements and everything, is that someone who's just calls themselves pastor, who's self-anointed or gets a group of people to lay hands on them, can ultimately influence hundreds or maybe thousands of people. And that's very troubling, because there's a lot more to being a pastor than just saying, well, God called me to preach. Well, there's a lot more than that when it comes to languages and church history and heritage. I know you're a Lutheran, so you can probably appreciate this more. But as a Baptist, I find that people sometimes say, well, that doesn't matter. Well, it does matter. And I'll throw this out to anyone out there that wants to go toe-to-toe with me. I've listened to some of those country bumpkin preachers before, and I heard one tell me one time that Jesus was walking around the fire with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and I'm like, gee, historically, that was, what, a few thousand years before Jesus came on the world scene? And, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm better than anyone else, but I've ran across preachers that have never went to school, and they want to say that they're my equal. Hello, excuse me, but yes, spiritually, you might be my equal as a leader of a church, but you don't know half of what I know. And I think that it's really wrong for these folks to put themselves out as church leaders when they don't know really anything about God's church. And when I say God's church, I mean Christ's church here on earth and what it's really all about.
Vince, thank you very much for the call. Now, he's kind of gone off in a different direction than I was headed a little bit. Vince is talking about essentially the need. Man, if there ever was a pressing need for the clergy to be well prepared than it is today. I mean, you talk about the times are changing. If there ever was a time when the clergy need to be well prepared, you know what I find more scandalous than that? Okay, I understand. I think there's a place in the church for the fellow who may not have the highest quality education, yet still is called of God. If it is, in fact, a genuine call that came from God through his people and not just some guy who decides one day, hey, I guess I'm a pastor because I decided I'm a pastor. There's a place for people in the church with less than, you know, the fully qualified formal education of the seminary and postgraduate degrees. There is. And it may be at a large congregation, a little one, doesn't make any difference. God moves the pawns on the chessboard around in a way that doesn't always make a lot of sense to us. What I find more outrageous are those who do have the benefit of a solid theological education, a background in the biblical languages. We're at one time taught what it is the Bible does clearly teach. Get out, get into the church, and announce it all to be irrelevant. Or a waste of time. Or, well, that was just a hoop I had to jump through, you know. Now, seminaries can't make pastors. The call of God makes pastors. and the congregations of God shape pastors. But the seminary can, a formal education, can give a guy a foundation in what the Bible teaches, in how the Bible says it in its original languages, in how to preach God's word, in how to think theologically, how to think critically. I was talking to a pastor this weekend. Back to something Miles said. And this pastor was rightly bemoaning kind of the state of affairs in the church at large. He was talking about the kind of training he got to be a pastor, where when he was in training to be a pastor, it was expected that when he got out into the church, he would go and see his people. He would know who they were and where they lived. Now, if you remember one of these super gigantic congregations, think about that. Does your pastor know where you live? I said, you know, maybe the seminaries would do well. The first thing they teach these guys before they send them out is how to read a map so they can find their people. I mean, a shepherd that can't find his sheep? Is there anything wrong with large congregations? Absolutely not. Not in principle. Is there a direction among congregations that have decided when they reach a certain size that, boy, you know, we must have gotten ourselves here? Oh, they'll say by the grace of God, yada, yada, yada. They'll stick all those things in as the kind of the asterisk, the little footnote on the rest of their boasting of their own prowess. Reminds me a lot of Nebuchadnezzar strutting around on the roof of his palace, looking out over his vast kingdom. And there's no doubt about it, it was his kingdom. I mean, it all belonged to him. And saying, I've gotten all this for myself. I'm master of everything I survey. If it weren't for me, it wouldn't be here. We can rest assured that God has a way of dealing with that kind of pride and arrogance, a kind of pride that would put itself, its methods, its prowess, its ideas over the power of God unto salvation for everyone who believes the humble preaching of Christ and Him crucified, which is the only way God has ever made or sustained His church for centuries anyway. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.